This podcast examines how every experience, every situation, every moment is an opportunity to work with our mind. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of Dharma talks, Dharma books, self-help books, and just generally the wisdom of others. I believe in the importance of showing gratitude, and the greatest way for me to do that is to share the tools, tips, and teachings of others that I've found immensely beneficial, which is why I started this podcast. My intention is to provide tools, ideas, and contemplations to benefit anyone who wants to listen, because life is workable and totally awesome. So this is a particularly exciting episode. I'm recording in Sydney, Australia, hence any ambient bird song that you might hear. And for the first time ever, I have a guest. Joining me is Gretchen Wagner. Gretchen has been a practicing Buddhist for over 12 years. She studied psychology and Indo-Tibetan Buddhism at Naropa University. And she's a tech/IT engineer who integrates the teachings and her practice into her role as a manager. And she also happens to be my fiancé that I am so often referring to in past episodes and also on my blog. Say hi, Gretchen.
Hi, Caitlin.
Because this is like radio, so they can't see you. So, on to the topic, which Gretchen inspired the idea for today's episode, which is all about pith. Or rather, pithy teachings, which Buddhism is totally full of pith. But pith can be found in loads of other places. So the title of this podcast, Everything is Workable, for example, is pure pith. And a lot of those memes that you see posted on people's Facebook feeds and stuff, there's a lot of pith in that.
Measure twice, cut once is a really common pith that I use a lot in engineering and here just about every day.
Very applicable. So by dictionary definition, it's a style of language that is terse and vigorously expressive, which just sounds really awesome. It's also the core of a stem in botanical terms, which I think is quite relevant to the language, and that's also why I've titled this particular episode Bones and Marrow. So dictionary definitions can be quite helpful, but really language is arbitrary and it changes a lot. So generally, as people know from listening to my podcast, I like to sort of delve into how we define things and different ways that they get defined and how I define it personally within my Buddhist practice. So let's talk about what makes something pithy. What makes something pithy for you, Gretchen?
Well, I think something's pithy when it's not exactly self-explanatory, nor really expressive of something that's just fundamentally true, but instead just points out something in your own understanding to make something really decisively clear, like measure twice, cut once. It is fairly self-explanatory, but in any situation it's like you need to be careful and to take that care before you make the unrecoverable step of cutting something.
That example that you give as well is one, it's almost could be said it's a cliche because it's quite quick and easy to say. It's nice and short. So I think another thing is with pithy stuff, there's this idea that it's very simple, short statements. But I don't think that's necessarily true. It doesn't always have to be succinct. It can actually be a few sentences sometimes, but still have that quality of pointing out something that people sort of already understand or have an experience of. It is also something that really gets to the core of that understanding. So within the Buddhist context, it gets to the core of a teaching. Or in something that's not necessarily in a Buddhist context, measure twice, cut once. It's just common sense, almost. So what else? What else makes something really pithy?
Another aspect of pith is it just pops your mind open into that aha, or oh, I see what you mean there. Again, not necessarily something that is itself, not so much the statement itself, but what it just really opens for you in your mind.
Okay, so to summarize then, pithy things, they point out something that's already in your understanding. It's not necessarily succinct, but it's never more than a few sentences. It's punchy.
Punchy, yeah.
And it gets to the core of a teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And then on hearing it, people often experience sort of that aha moment. Makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. A little bit more esoteric maybe for your general audience here, but in the structure of Zen koans, there's a sort of poetic form to it. And at the end of every koan, of a particular book of koans, there's like the capping verse. And the capping verse is itself sort of the pithy statement for the entire koan, which can be like pages long.
Koan, just so the listeners who might not be familiar with it, the best definition I heard was from, you guessed it, Pema Chodron. Which is a question that can't be answered with the conceptual mind. So the common ones that get heard in pop culture are what's the sound of one hand clapping, or if a tree falls in the woods and no one can hear it, does it make a sound? That kind of thing. Zen's very good with koans, and actually I feel like they're much more powerful ones. Haven't been analyzed to death by Western culture. So that brings us to some examples.
Examples.
And Zen is very good. So we've actually got three books between the two of us that we decided to have a bit of a discussion. What are some of the pithiest books that we've ever read? So I've chosen and nominated Everyday Zen by Charlotte Joko Beck.
And I chose Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Shunryu Suzuki.
So two Zen teaching books, very Zen Dharma. And then both of us agreed that Glimpses of Mahayana by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche is incredibly pithy.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Mahayana teachings.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of pith in them. So what we're going to do is share some examples of some of these pithy things and how they fit into those categories that we've mentioned. You know, really pointing something out, being punchy, getting to the core of a teaching, and giving people an aha moment of illumination.
Mm-hmm.
So, Gretchen, would you like to kick us off?
So, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind is full of all manner of pithy things. So it's difficult to pick just one, but I can just literally open the book and find something that, at least in this copy, Kate has underlined a lot of good examples. but what I like is, the purpose of studying Buddhism is not to study Buddhism, but to study ourselves. I like this one because it's just true. It keeps coming back. Every conversation I have with anybody who doesn't practice Buddhism or know much about it, about Buddhism, this is a fundamental point to really explain and have to explain at length, because it doesn't make sense from the outside what all of this Buddhism stuff is about. But it's ourselves and our experience. Everything that we experience moment to moment is the study and practice of Buddhism. And that this text comes back to that point over and over again in a wide variety of ways. So the purpose of studying Buddhism is not to study Buddhism, but to study ourselves. All of Buddhism is about providing a structure and some methods, some understanding around that study of ourselves.
So my nominated book, Everyday Zen by Charlotte Joko Beck, when I first finished reading this book, I wrote a blog entry in my old blog about it where I highlighted all of the pithiness. I think I pulled out like 25, 30 lines from it. And that was me sort of trying to keep it to a minimum. What I appreciate about this book, I mean, there's a lot that I appreciate everything about this book, but she talks a lot about relationships in it, which is something that within Buddhist teachings, relationship, like intimate relationships, aren't always discussed because there's a lot of monasticism. So there's not a lot of relationships outside of the relationship you have with yourself and your own mind. What I appreciate about this book and the entire section of relationships is how she goes into depth about what Gretchen was just sharing, how the study of the self is something you can do in relationship with somebody else. So here's an example of something pithy, but not necessarily succinct, but still really punchy and to the point. A good relationship gives life more power. If two people are strong together, then life has a more powerful channel than it has with two single people. It's almost as though a third and larger channel has been formed. And I feel like this is very pithy because from my own experience, it definitely speaks to my own experience and sort of an aha of, you know, you've got a really strong connection with someone, whether it's actually an intimate relationship or just even a really strong friendship, when you have that sense of something a bit bigger than yourself. How this is just saying, like, it's because of cultivating that self-awareness and because of that person having some sense of self-awareness as well, and the way that you can come together and create something bigger, which is very powerful. And that's also really nice because when I come across it in Buddhism, I think that there's a lot in Buddhism that almost teaches that you shouldn't go into relationships and things like detachment, the way they talk about attachment and non-attachment, you can get the idea that we should be very solitary in our practice. And this is a nice pithy statement that's saying, actually, when you're not solitary in your practice, it's very, very powerful.
Not even just when you're not solitary, but when it's shared.
Exactly. Do you have another example from
your book? In this particular edition of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, there are sort of little section headings, which are themselves a pithy statement from the section that follows. So one is, because we enjoy all aspects of life as an unfolding of big mind, we do not care for any excessive joy. So we have imperturbable composure. Enjoying all aspects of life as an unfolding. What this brings up for me in my own practice experience is, I remember when I was first getting started as a Buddhist practitioner, I was often distracted by the higher experiences or the lower experiences of meditation. Either it was an incredible drag and terribly boring and nothing was happening at all, and I was, you know, experiencing physical discomfort and falling asleep.
Hot boredom.
or it was like blissful and exciting and full of like radiating love and joy and peace and all of that kind of stuff. So I would have experiences that were great and I would want to get back to those. And I thought that if I wasn't having those, that I wasn't doing it right. It took years of practice to kind of shake that that perception and expectation off. Now I think like 12-ish years into it, I'm at a place where that unfolding of practice, no matter how it looks day to day, no matter what's happening, it's the practicing itself that matters. So whether there's excessive joy or nothing at all or anything in between, it's the imperturbable composure of practice, the groundedness or the solidity of just staying and being present and observing the unfolding of my experience, observing my mentation or thought processes around it. All of that becomes workable, regardless of what the content is.
Oh, that's brilliant. That ties in really well then with something incredibly succinct from everyday Zen that I've got highlighted here. Enlightenment is not something you achieve. Which is
very pithy.
And also something I think a lot of people, especially Western students, seem to really struggle with, and I know I definitely struggled with. I felt like enlightenment was like, you know, I want to get it right. It was sort of like this thing. I felt like because I was reading Dharma and I was meditating and studying, I should be together. I should be able to get it together. I should get things done. And my psychologist was a great support with this, actually, because I would talk to her sometimes and be so frustrated because I did that thing. And why am I not? And she would just say to me, well, you're frustrated because you're not enlightened yet. And it's not thinking about enlightenment as a goal. It's thinking about how you just experience practice in your day-to-day life, and which feeds into another one that I've highlighted in this book. Practice is not trimming on your life. Practice is the foundation. So it's understanding that enlightenment is actually an experience, a day-to-day experience, and we can tap into at any moment when we have clarity of mind.
Funny enough, that's just like the last one I flagged to share as a pithy statement. When you become you, Zen becomes Zen. When you are you, you see things as they are, and you become one with your surroundings. Again, this to me points out something that I've seen in my own experience in meditation. There's a lot of Zen teaching that I've either heard while on a Japanese Zen meditation retreat or in a Zen course at Naropa or just in reading my own. A lot of Zen has a poetic quality to it that's about relating to aspects of nature, the sound of wind rustling in leaves and so on. Seeing things as they are and becoming one with your surroundings. In my own experience, I've seen the sense of being so centered around me having an experience and me perceiving dissolve into more of simply perceiving and perception. The sound of wind rustling in leaves, losing its objecthood and almost becoming a moments of subjectivity. A sense of color in the sky, losing its objecthood and becoming something that I dissolve into. These are temporary states and just parts of a meditation practice, but I think cultivating that is part of the practice. It also reminds me of something I heard Reggie Ray say, and Reggie Ray is a good example of a teacher who just is constantly dropping pithy statements one after another. Is the Dharma is you, or that you express the Dharma by sharing who and what you are.
So that ties in well then with Glimpses of Mahayana, which Reggie Ray is a student of Trogom Trungpa Rinpoche, and highlighted here, renunciation means realizing the nuisance of yourself.
That's a good one.
It is a good one. I like CTR because he's very cutting.
Yeah, that's an aspect of pith. It can be very cutting, piercing, penetrating.
So this is interesting in relation to what you just read from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and looking at sense of self and sort of this, the difference between ego self, mm-hmm. ego clinging self, which has a lot of attachment, lots of resistance, lots of that, as I like to say, clinging to what you want and pushing away what you don't want. And seeing how that is a nuisance, having that sense of identity. So in this practice of studying the self, my experience of it is seeing how little my world is when it's all about me versus when I can look at it in relationship to humanity and being human.
Hmm.
So renunciation means realizing the nuisance of yourself. Renunciation, I mean, in this context, is talking about renunciation within different vows that are taken in Buddhist practice. And how that renunciation, it does like a trigger in my brain anyway, that's how it works. It's like a trigger where I need to be more aware of things because I've actually taken a formal vow to renunciate certain things. I've taken a vow, so I'm aware of when I'm doing something from a place of ego versus when I'm doing it from that place of openness and connectivity mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. and fullness of a situation, seeing and appreciating the fullness of a situation.
Mm-hmm. I see some of this in my work as an engineering manager. There's a necessity of continually stepping into the background of what my team is doing. It's as if I have to continually forefront their successes and celebrate them as individuals and as a team. And my own contribution and leadership of that it's quite secondary. And that's not any kind of humility on my part. It's like that's really my job. What makes them successful is that my efforts are for their prominence and not my own, if that makes any sense. But I find often that it's not that I want to take credit for anything that they do. It's just that there are many little and continual ways that I'm looking for recognition myself. But that's not what my job is about.
That ties in very well with another one. Do you notice how all this pith ties in really well with each other?
Mm-hmm. It's as if they're all saying the same thing.
Funny that. About the spiritual friend. A spiritual friend, very common in Buddhist teachings. So the spiritual friend is not a person who undermines our existence and our neurosis, but a person who speaks the same neurotic language we speak. He or she is an extraordinarily adaptable person. So taking that role of spiritual friend is interesting. It is about that. Like, we're talking about how you've cultivated that self-awareness. And in doing so, even if you're working with someone who isn't necessarily cultivating that self-awareness, you can still relate to them from that place of, like, within Buddhism, you're not on a pedestal. Nobody's on a pedestal. There's, again, that's a common misunderstanding, this idea of, I think, guru devotion kind of gets skewed that way.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that you recognize the similarity of everyone. You just see the struggle of humanity. You can relate to people in that way. And it makes everything very relatable. It makes it easier day to day, like, especially in professional situations. Mm-hmm. I do it all the time at mm-hmm. work. And if I'm watching coworkers kind of struggling to communicate, and mm-hmm. I'm like, well, you know, I know what it's like to feel misunderstood, and trying to come in with some skillful language and yeah. appreciate that everyone's really neurotic in their own way.
Yeah. I find it's really actually very easy to do. I just have to cultivate my own sense of genuineness and try to continually relate to other people from that sense of genuineness, rather than from any kind of strategic understanding of what's going on for them and what I'm perceiving about them. I just honestly try to come from the heart, but without any method around that other than be genuine and kind, and in the workplace context, appropriate. And it seems to be working. It seems to be helpful.
Pith. Very helpful. Very helpful. Well, thank you so much, Gretchen.
Oh, you're welcome.
For being my very first guest. Very exciting. Do you want to say hi to your mom?
Hi, Mom. My mother listens to this podcast and she loves it.
Thank you, as ever, for listening. I'm actually coming towards the end of this season, if you will, of it. I'm going to be taking a break very soon throughout December and January. And I would like to do more episodes with as interviews and have more guests on. So if there's someone you'd like to nominate to be a guest, or if you yourself think, I've got some brilliant stuff about how everything is workable that I'd like to share, please let me know. You can get in touch with me through email or through social media channels. I'm really easy to find. Just search for Fauna Wolf. Thank you.
'Thank you so much for listening to Everything is Workable. My content will always be free, but if you'd like to help make it even better, you can become a patron by clicking the green button at the top of the page. I'm always looking for content suggestions and people to interview. If you've got any ideas or would like to contribute, you can get in touch through my website, www.faunawolfcreations.com. That's faunawolfcreations.com. Thank you to the very talented Dexter Britton for sharing his music with the world. The music used in this podcast is from his Creative Commons Volume 5 album, available on www.dexterbritton.co.uk.